presentation in English, although I could have done it in a different language. So this will take us away a little bit from the question of language, because I will be talking about memories of a travel to France rather than the actual use of the language. I have a theoretical introduction to my paper, but as a way to preempt the inexorable course of time, I will skip over that. I won't even mention what it is about. In memory studies, we're used to the assumption that collective public memory not only sustains individual memory, but also affects it very strongly. And you know, this comes from Nora's ideas, which leads to a kind of a gap between public memory, collective memory, and private memory. And what I wanted to suggest in this paper is that sometimes very private memories are made public and made respectable in so doing, and that therefore we're really thinking about going back and forth between the public and the private, in particular when we talk about aristocratic society. But I will not develop this idea. What I will be doing here is to look at the ways in which gardens of the aristocracy in the late 18th century, early 19th century have encoded biographical time, and in particular how this self-exhibition has flaunted the crossing of borders and reveals networks of sociability and structures of identification that transcend geographical boundaries. Because of the centrality of French in aristocratic culture, I will focus on memories of travel to France and of readings from French literature, but I'm not really claiming that French has any sort of intrinsic or unique status here. I think German is equally important in this regard. I will have three case studies. The first one is a very well-known one. It's Pavlovsk, and then I will have two which are a little bit less well-known. The Garden of Maria Fyodorovna at Pavlovsk provides an interesting example of a memorial garden. From its very inception, it displayed highly personal memories related to the Grand Duchess' childhood in Montbéliard and her family's summer residence of Etupes and of her travels. Some of the first buildings erected in the Gardens of Pavlovsk are imitations of, or at least are inspired by, features of her family's gardens. So, for example, Hryzhina at Chilnica, the hermit's cell, goes back to the hermitage at Etupes and evokes a prank that her uncle played upon her. The dairy is explicitly modeled after plans of a dairy at Montbéliard, the estate of her uncle. The charcoal burner's hut refers to a structure in the garden of Hohenheim. The old chalet, also known as the Swiss chalet, has likewise a prototype in Hohenheim. It was built before the Grand Duchess and the Grand Duke took off on their famous trip through Europe in 1781-82, but after the trip it acquired additional layers of memory. Indeed, the rustic style of garden structures that were built initially in Pavlovsk resonated with the hameau at Chantilly, which Paul and Maria visited, which made a very profound impression on the traveling couple. Paul is reputed to have told the Prince de Condé that he would give all he had for acquiring Chantilly. And there the princely couple found simple thatched buildings, which provided the setting for a Rousseau-inspired performance of Jouer à la Bergère, sort of a ritual of social divestiture which Maria Fyodorovna then carried on in Pavlovsk when she dressed as a shepherdess and played that game with her children tending to the gardens and so on and so forth. So clearly the residence of Chantilly in the mind and heart of the two travelers was amplified by the fact that Pavlovsk had already some of these rustic architecture and that there was therefore a kindred spirit. But the reception they were given at Chantilly, which was anything but lavish, included a gondola trip to the Temple of Venus on the Island of Love, an illumination displaying the entwined coats of armor of the two travelers, and so on and so forth. All of this obviously augmented the sentimental resonance of these associations. In fact, the Garden of Chantilly and the memory of its visit became later on one of the main reference points for Pavlovsk. Subsequently, for example, the old Sylvia was built. This is a 12th radiating path developed by Vincenzo Brenna after Paul was already emperor. And that's a reference to Sylvie de Montmorency, who had been the mistress at Chantilly and was honored by several installations there, including Jardin de Sylvie, La Maison de Sylvie. And there was also this network of 12 radiating paths there. In 1798, Pietro Gonzaga designed the Island of Love, which was again an imitation of the Island of Love at Chantilly, and so on and so forth. There are other gardens that they visited on that trip in 81-82, which also left an imprint on Pavlovsk. For example, the Peel Tower may have been inspired by the Marble Tower in the Jardin des Mesdames at Bellevue, and of course the aviary is modeled upon classical buildings that they saw in Italy. So the interesting question for me here is whether all these encoded references to the past and to the the semi private life of the Grand Duchess, to her childhood, to her journey to France, whether those were revealed publicly, and whether contemporaries who visited Pavlovsk were aware of these sort of layers of memories. And if you look at the texts that were written at the time, the descriptions of Pavlovsk, poetic or otherwise, for example, of course, Zhukovsky's Slavyanka, but also Heinrich Dorst's letters on Pavlovsk, or the memoirs of Savlukov, who was the head of the command of the garrison of soldiers who were there for the protection of the Grand Duke and his wife. All of these texts do not make reference to this private layer of memory. There is an awareness that subsequently, once the family member Maria Fyodorovna began to die, once Paul was assassinated, and the garden became a much more explicit memorial garden with all kinds of structures being rededicated to the deceased members of the family. That awareness is present in all those descriptions, but not the references back to the trip of 1781-82, nor to the childhood of Maria Fyodorovna, which suggests to me that she wasn't, even though these texts show quite a bit of intimate knowledge about how she walked through the gardens and what she did there and so on and so forth. So that suggests to me that she wasn't too explicit and was rather private about this family genealogy of the garden. One monument that is strikingly missing in Pavlovsk is any sort of tribute to Paul's mother, who you all know had soured towards her daughter-in-law once her relationship with Paul became difficult. It was normal practice in Russian landscape design to erect a monument, usually a pyramid, to memorialize the visit of the Empress, for example. And the absence of any of the such structure at Pavlovsk is significant, if understandable, all the more so that there is, for example, a vase set on the pedestal with an inscription memorializing the visit of Frederick William, the Crown Prince of Prussia, the future Frederick William II, who came secretly in 1780. And considering, of course, Catherine's hostility to Prussia, that's a significant visit, and the fact that it was openly acknowledged in this way is kind of a show of some sort of willful independence on the part of the inhabitants of Pavlovsk. But by and large, it would be fair to say, I think, that Pavlovsk is not a political garden. Maria Fyodorovna quite deliberately endowed it with a sentimental rather than with a political meaning, as a physical manifestation of a network of family ties that reaches past, reaches into the past, but also across boundaries, as a memento of the Grand Tour that was so important to her and to Paul. And the incipient, the intended recipient, really, the consumer of this design, is really herself rather than anyone else. So it's the family in this kind of narrow sense. So memory is experienced here not as a repository of stories or images that can be recalled at will, nor as a set of associations, but really as a sort of reenactment, right? It's the theater of memory as an attempt to live and relive in the past in a fairly private capacity. And what could be tempted to refer to Rothman's idea of theatricality of aristocratic culture, except that here it's not an alien self that is being enacted, right? But it's rather a former self, an intimate identity that endures despite of the new roles that the Grand Duchess and then subsequently the Empress has to enact. Nevertheless, in a limited sense, to emphasize the experiential nature of this memory performance, I call this the theater of memory in which the recollection of similar moments of her life become the central component of her identity and a definite central dimension of the present. So that's the first case study. The second one now refers to Ivan Lavrukhin's estate at Savinskaya, which is a very interesting estate that has also generated quite a bit of writing. As you probably all know, Lavrukhin had quite a turbulent career as his Masonic ties and intense publishing activities made him suspect in Catherine's eyes. He was forced to retire from service in 1785, when he was asked to forswear his Masonic affiliation, and he refused, saying that being a Mason made him a better public servant, and therefore he wanted to continue. He was closely associated with Nabokov and escaped banishment and exile only because he had his blind father in his care, and therefore he was assigned to residency in Moscow. Once Paul became emperor, he attempted again to serve at court, and he was a good friend of Paul, but that attempt ended quite quickly on account of his moral intransigence. And at that point, he started developing his estate in Savinskaya, thinking that he would peacefully retire there. So 1801, 1802 are the sort of the peaks of his interest for the estate. But at that point, he's recalled to service by Alexander, and he reluctantly accepts. Now the gardens are testimonial to his philosophical interests and materialize, as it were, his intellectual and spiritual journey. And the gardens reflect his quietest convictions. They feature tributes to Fénelon, Madame Guyon, Jacob Böhme, Karl von Eckartshausen, Quirinus Kuhlmann, in addition to slightly more standard fare, Ernst Young, Diogenes, Socrates, Lomonosov, and then his uncle and protector Nikolai Lipnin. More intriguingly, the estate also featured Figino Rousseau, which included two inscriptions on the theme of freedom from society and self-reliance. The first one is, in a literal translation, the wildest solitude seems to be preferable to the society of the wicked. La plus sauvage solitude me paraît préférable à la société des méchants. That's from Rêverie du promeneur solitaire. And the other one from Emile, slightly modified, is only he is really free who does not need to put someone else's arm at the end of his own to get his way. Celui-là vraiment est libre, qui n'a pas besoin de mettre le bras d'un autre au bout des siens pour faire sa volonté. So what is interesting here is that Lavrukhin, who had been infatuated with Rousseau in his youth, had sharply turned against him and generally against reason and enlightenment philosophy. As he registered in his memoirs, which were written in 1808, 1809, he had enjoyed reading Voltaire's mockery and Rousseau's rebuttals and other such works. But at some point, as he was in the process of translating D'Holbach's Système de la Nature, he experienced a kind of epiphany when suddenly he realized the sinfulness of his work. So he burned the manuscript of his translations and proceeded to write a pamphlet called On the Abuse of Reason by Several Modern Writers. Um, And then he proceeded to write two treatises directed against Rousseau, 20 years apart, one in 1784, one in 1805. So really this hostility against Rousseau spans most of his intellectual life, and yet on his estate he creates a monument to Rousseau. So this is there is a certain bifurcated response to L'homme de la nature et de la vérité, which I find interesting. I think Rousseau is quoted here on the estate not for what he represents philosophically or ideologically, but for his stance of moral independence from society, for his passionate self-reliance, or at least what was perceived as such, and quite possibly also for the memory La Bourquine had of his youthful infatuation with Rousseau. So the garden creates a distinction between the quest for moral freedom, in particular freedom from the constraints of patronage relations, and the ideological, political ramifications of commitment to freedom. In the Zapiski, La Bourquine also writes about the causes of the French Revolution and mentions the Système de Philosophes and so on and so forth. So Rousseau in his shack, living in the self-sufficient simplicity, and that's of course a reference to the last weeks of his life at Ermenonville, becomes a mirror of the sacrifice La Bourquine is willing to make for the sake of preserving his honor and dignity. And if one juxtaposes the garden with La Bourquine's memoirs, one sees a man who insists on his inborn aspiration to do good and on his inability to use reason to hold his passion in check. So much like Rousseau, La Bourquine posits this innate disposition towards good, which society and practical reason may corrupt, and the strictures of patronage relations impose a certain logic of behavior which deflects from the innate good, and which La Bourquine, like Rousseau, is unwilling and unable to accept. For example, he notes that he disliked festivities and feasts, that he never threw such parties, despite the conventions of the time, that he also wasn't into gambling and so on and so forth. We should note, by the way, that he was heavily indebted at the time, and that subsequently, during the reign of Alexander I, he wrote a contorted petition to the Tsar asking him if he would purchase one of his estates to allow him to settle his debt. So rather than simply asking for a favor, he proposes an economic transaction. You buy an estate and I get the money which enables me to repay my debt. And he makes a big point in his petition, which he includes in his Zapiski, to emphasize that in so doing, he preserves his honor, and that he had a possibility at the beginning of Paul's reign to simply ask for his debt to be forgiven, but he didn't want to receive unmotivated a gift, and therefore offered this kind of financial scheme. And Alexander didn't really work back that he wasn't in the business of purchasing estates, but simply gave him a slightly more generous pension. So that the point is that La Bourquine tried in all different ways to escape the logic and the obligations that come with patronage relations. So throughout the notes, we see that patronage is seen as a political sphere whose logic interferes with the Christian and the Masonic pursuit of truth and good, and which therefore needs to be rejected as much as possible. And the identification with Rousseau, I think, rests on this notion of overcoming practical reason and following the voice of truth. And in the context of Rousseau's reputation as one of the instigators of the revolution, there is something quite unpolitic about flaunting this attachment to him, yet this is precisely what makes such an installation, right, Rousseau Occasion, attractive to La Bourquine, all the more so that it brings up his youthful passion for the philosopher and writer. Now, my last case study, if I have another 4 minutes or so, is Alexandre Kourakine and his estate of Nadezhda. I've written about this before, and I won't repeat what I said. I will focus only on the ways in which the trip of 1781-82, in which Alexandre Borisovitch participated, is being reflected in the landscape of design, or rather in the ways in which Borakin writes about it. But just, you know, by way of a little bit of context, when, you know, in his first journey abroad in 1771-72, Borakin writes to Nikita Panin, his trustee, that all the duties he will have abroad, and I quote, will never erase in me the sentiments of an industrious and sensible patriot, and that he strove to approach his life, and I quote again, not as an Epicureanist, but as a cosmopolitan who dedicates himself to the public good. And yet, you know, this commitment to Russia did not mean a commitment to Catherine, because he was close to, in this group, because he was educated by the Panin brothers, close to Paul's circle, took part, as I said, in the trip of 1781-82, and on the occasion of this trip, he allowed himself some derogatory comments about Potemkin in a correspondence which was perlustrated, and as a result was banished from the court of Catherine. So there's a complicated story, but I won't get into it. So in effect, he retires to the estate of Nadezhda and begins the process of transforming it as a kind of incarnation of his memories. Accordingly, his philosophy has changed. He begins to focus much more on himself, seeking a kind of Epicureanist enjoyment of life, and claiming only that he's, through his readings, preparing himself for service in the future, but doesn't really show an inclination to serve anyone, not even Paul at that point. So all his letters can be the sense of a hedonistic pursuit of happiness and nothing more than that. And he continuously defends, because he is taken to task by his friends for that, he defends himself. When he sets up the estate, he calls certain alleys architectural units after some moral values, and then in particular after the people that are dear to his heart. So, for example, he writes to his friend Nilidova in 1794, "The nomenclature of the alleys of my garden here is nothing but a summary of the attachments that fill or have filled my heart. It would be a sure guide for those who would like to know it." So all his friends are named in the garden in one way or the other. Now, what is interesting is that in the archive, this nomenclature changes over time, and he prepares plans of the garden with a legend that shows, you know, which alley is called which, and so on and so forth. And there are various versions of these plans, and one of them in particular includes all kinds of references to the trip of 1781-82. So that includes the Pavillon Condé, the Alley of Chantilly, the Crossing of Sylvia, that of Marie Antoinette, the Circle of Bourbon, and several more. So the garden, or rather the map of the garden, discloses a kind of a network of personal relations, of friendly ties, of places that he visited, and that are all linked with a life-determining past event. And all these toponyms are given both in French and Russian, which really shows that there was an intention to make this public, and to, you know, disseminate these plans to various people. In the surviving, the ones that are still existing in the archive, the surviving maps of the garden, only the reference to Marie Antoinette remains, but it is given added prominence in the wake of her death in 1793, when Borakin decided to erect a pyramid in her memory. So the inscription to Marie Antoinette offers her permanent abode in the garden, or even rule over it. It says, "But you will reign eternally in these places, where tranquility rules, where fear is unknown." In other words, the garden, which, you know, features Elysian fields and a temple called the Receptacle of Eternal Feelings, the garden writes itself into eternity, as it were, and Borakin treats it not only as a personal eternal memory, he treats memory not only as his kind of mental horizon, but also as a sort of platonic shadow of something that endures forever. Marie Antoinette receives sovereignty, as it were, over this Elysium, in a clear switch of allegiance. It's a bit of a snub at Catherine, really, to do that and to publicize that. So the garden becomes an imaginary space of an alternative patronage, an alternative relationship of patronage, in which the bond between ruler and subject is felt as inalienable or immune to the fear of disgrace or rebellion that marks patronage relations in Catherine's reign. So from the cosmopolitan who in 1772 had professed his commitment to public service to Russia, now we have a cosmopolitan who seeks hedonistic self-contentment and lives in a kind of a compensatory realm of imaginary patronage relationship with a deceased empress, rooted in friendship and in the memory of an encounter in the past. So the paradox here is that on the one hand, Kurakin remains a friend of Paul and continuously is being asked to come to Paul's court and to pay his respects, and he continuously tries to avoid that and writes letters asking that he's much more at peace here in Nadiezhda and so on and so forth. But on the other side, he designs the estate as a kind of a memorial to his relationships with the heir to the throne. So, for example, in 1789, he invites Paul to draw plans for his estate mansion, assuring him that, and I quote, "I dare to expect a plan from you as a gracious gift, and it will be a very real one for me, as I love to surround myself with everything that can remind me of your kindness and of the ties that bind me to you." So there's a disjunction, right, between concrete service to the heir to the throne. Yeah, I'm almost done. And this kind of more abstract, statements of faithfulness and loyalty. And his friends, have taken him to task for that. For example, Rybnin asks, "How dare you reject the entreaties of your friends under the poor pretext that you are more tranquil where you are? In other words, that your vain glory is better nourished and flattered than here where one wishes you to be," right? So he avoids going to St. Petersburg, according to Lippmann, because there he risks not to be treated as sumptuously as he would wish to be treated. So, in conclusion, right? So we have three brief and sketchy case studies, and I've shown how the materialization of personal memory in space has helped members of the upper crust of the aristocracy to carve out a space of independence from the constraints of patronage relations, regardless of the political implications of the messages that they convey. So, in each case, the memory is invoked in a slightly different manner, but in each case, traveling across boundaries and across time is of the essence. So for Maria Fyodorovna, the garden was itself the project of living or reliving the past, taking part in what I've called the theater of memory. For Lapukhin, it's a method to associate himself visibly with someone who was not only the object of youthful infatuation, but also who exemplifies the practice of moral independence, regardless of social norms. And finally, for Kurakin, he displays intimatized in a show of moral commitment to his private life and to the pursuit of happiness, while operating a disjunction between symbolic expressions of fidelity and practical day-to-day commitments to his friends. So he inscribed himself in abstract, eternal, and unchanging patronage relations, thus substituting an ideal vision of patronage to the messy reality of patronage in Catherine's reign. So all three of my heroes solicited memory, as I said, to carve out a space immune to the pressures of patronage relations, but they do it not simply by retreating into private life, but by making their private memories public, and that's kind of the message that they convey. That's it. Thank you very much.